Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Amber Data Derivatives Podcast. I'm here with Varun Kumar, who is the co-founder and CEO of Hashflow, which is a DeFi DEX that has a lot of unique features to it. Varun, how are you?
I am lovely. What's going on?
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Well, I'm super excited to have you on here. I definitely want to jump into everything about Hashflow. There's a lot of unique features there that I'd love to touch on. And outside of that, maybe we could just touch on a little bit about your background. So before starting Hashflow, before jumping into the crypto space, you know, where did you find yourself? And what did you do before that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an interesting background because I did not have any finance background, despite the fact that now I'm actually running a fintech company. It's fintech, I suppose. Can we still use that word? All right, you know. Okay, fine. We'll go fintech. So my background is in aerospace and physics, right? So, and then after that, I was working in the aerospace industry for like nearly 3 to 4 years. At first, we were building cube satellites to do Earth imagery from low Earth orbit. So I was building flights for control systems for small sats. And then after that, I spent some time working on drones and basically building reconnaissance and control systems for unmanned aerial vehicles. So a few years doing that. But it was during that time frame I discovered crypto, and I was doing crypto on the side, mostly just aping into random shit coins for a while before 2019, 2020 came in, where I'm like, you know what? I like crypto to the point where I should probably be working in this industry full time, because I've always wanted to do a startup for a while. And I was like, obviously looking into various industries to see where, what I'm really passionate about, and various opportunity, and crypto just happened to be the one I really just aligned, both from a philosophical standpoint and then also just the potential of what we could do, right? So, and just to throw a bit more light on the philosophy part, the idea was essentially so personally, I mean, I care a lot about the values I care about are like individual freedom and self-sovereignty. That have always been the two of the things I cared about a lot.
Yeah.
And when it came about, I'm like, for the first time, this is like the internet of the 90s, where for the first time, if you think of money as a technology, and for the first time, you have money that cannot be manipulated or controlled by any single authority in the world. For the first time, you have a truly decentralized money that can not be used as a means to control the population. Right? So essentially, you truly have, freedom in the true sense from essentially transacting in Bitcoin. Right? So, and I'm like, well, that's pretty powerful. Obviously, the technology is still nascent in the sense that it hasn't really gotten to the point where everyone just uses Bitcoin, but you're not quite there yet, right? But at the same time, if I want to be part of something that actually disrupts the whole idea in which we transact value, and this is the moment, right? So I'm like, okay, fine, this is where I want to be. So that sort of took me down the crypto rabbit hole, and now here we are.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I really share a lot of that sentiment. Like, crypto is one of those pure assets that you can own it. It's not in some way implicitly guaranteed by the government in terms of private property rights. So that's pretty interesting. I definitely share that sentiment. Before jumping into Hashflow, one of the things that I did notice about Hashflow is, you guys span across EVM chains as well as Solana. When you first got into crypto, were you more into Bitcoin, Ethereum, or kind of what was your main attraction in terms of the different coins that you were investing in and following?
Well, I joined in 2015 time. That's when I first got my first Bitcoin. Right, so, I think obviously fast forward a year and a half later, Ethereum was my second thing that I aped into in like mid-2016-ish after the Ethereum ICO happened. And then I bought a bunch of like Zcash and Monero and a bunch of other random coins that came about during that time frame. All right, so including Litecoin and all that. But and then obviously 2017 ICO happened, and then fast forward, over time, started diving deeper into learning, teaching myself how to write Solidity.
And, oh, cool.
And over time, you know, went down the Ethereum rabbit hole. And then I still hold Bitcoin and I still have Ethereum. So I don't really, back in the day, I'm like, this chain is going to be winner and everything is going to lose. And I think over time, it's a non-zero sum. Like, if there's not going to be a world where one chain to rule them all is the world we live in, it's going to be some combination of a bunch of different chains with communities that find utility value in being part of that tribe, right? It's almost like network states, as Balaji would put it. It's as though you have like these internet nations that are living on the web, and then these currencies dictate essentially ones that align with the values of those communities. They'll just end up using those currencies or currency units.
Yeah, that makes
sense. If you think about, it was Anton.
I was just saying, yeah, that makes sense. I see what you're saying for sure.
Yeah, because I was going to say, right? Because the thing with Bitcoin and Bitcoin community, the way they think, the values they share is fundamentally different than the way people in Ethereum think, like, and it's completely different than the way people in Solana think, like, right? So, yes, are they all engineers who believe in crypto and like free world? Sure. But then even once you double click on each of these people, it's like a whole different culture, right? And you can see that like with every new rising community and things that they care about or value, that you can almost think of these as nation states that live on the internet and people with, you know, similar cultural interests, they align themselves around like, you know, particular thing, and that's kind of where they rally around, right? So anyway,
That's really interesting. A friend of mine who's been probably a friend of yours actually as well, he once said that sort of crypto, in a way, when there's a hard fork, it kind of makes them think of religion, where it's like, oh, this is Catholic, this is Protestant. It's like a hard fork in the different belief systems. And you could kind of see that with different coins and philosophies and the chains they live on. One of the things that's really interesting about Hashflow, actually, and so, you know, maybe you can give us a brief background, but I just want to make this comment, is that you guys ease the transactions between different chains. So you don't necessarily have to bridge between AVAX and mainnet or optimism and mainnet, so on and so forth. And so that is actually a really interesting feature of Hashflow. But maybe you can just give us a brief overview of the protocol. So for anyone who hasn't, traded on Hashflow before or isn't familiar with the protocol yet, you know, what are the things they should know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I think high level, Hashflow is a decentralized exchange. Right, that's how it began. The idea was to start on Ethereum and then expand over to other EVM chains, and eventually now be on Solana as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and fundamentally, the way it works is if you use something like Robinhood and so on. So the way our design philosophy works is like, you know, simplicity in UX, 20 times anything else.
Mm.
So if there is a decision to be made between ease of use, so I said it's design constraint that makes us look more cool. I would rather pick the ease of use and simplicity, right? So, and that's so where we were netted on an RFQ structure. Because our philosophy is like, you know, the future at some point, everything is going to converge to RFQs, where your market makers or people who are spending hours of compute time and resources at pricing assets are the best people to create markets, right? So, and in fact, if you look at AMMs and Uniswap and such, which run these on-chain pricing models, they essentially use reference price on the centralized exchanges as a way to basically come up with the, you know, incentivize people to trade against the AMM pools by finding arbitrage opportunities, right? So, really, in a sense, you're looking for external oracles, which are coming from pricing on these exchanges. And the markets and price discovery on those exchanges happen through market makers. So, like, you might as well just go and build a DeFi RFQ system where your pricing happens, you know, essentially a trader comes there, they request a quote, they receive a quote from a maker, and then you execute the trade itself on chain. So essentially, you are removing all the complexity from blockchain, and you're doing them off chain, And the only thing you do on chain is the swap between the two users. So simply put, it can be thought of as an OTC desk on steroids, where you connect your wallet, you request a quote, you receive an OTC quote from all the market makers that we aggregate, and then you perform the swap, right? So that's like hash flow in a nutshell. And then obviously now we are expanding to becoming more of an aggregator as opposed to just being an RFQ system that we can talk about. But I wanted that answer to your question so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess from one of the nice like things that the market maker will bring when they, well, there's a couple of nice things when they respond with an RFQ is A, the quote, usually with an RFQ, you request the asset and the size you want to trade. So there's no slippage because the RFQ includes the whole size. So that's really interesting. The price that you see is the price you get for your whole lot. And then the other thing that's pretty interesting is, you know, across chain. So I guess a market maker who has a big, you know, business will probably have assets on multiple chains and so on and so forth. Is that how the ease of, you know, not needing to bridge assets comes from? Because I do an RFQ for selling Ethereum mainnet token and getting it back on Optimism. Really, the market maker on the other side is facilitating that? Or how does that process become facilitated?
Yeah, I mean, once you take the RFQ route, where, like you said, market maker just gives you the quote on a particular pair, and then you just execute the swap. Like, you don't have to worry about slippage, front running, anything else, because nothing is happening on chain, except the swap itself. So, and verifying the signature that, you know, the right counterparty has, in fact, signed the transaction. So the same principle applies even to cross-chain, except what's happening is the two transfers that happen on the respective chains, right? So I'll give an example. If you go from Ethereum to, let's say, Solana, right? So take a trader requests a quote to swap like one ETH for like 10 SOL, and then they receive a quote from market maker who signs it. And then what's going on is you have the first transfer where Ethereum moves from a user's wallet into market maker's wallet on Ethereum. And once that has happened, we use Wormhole to basically relay that message. So you have Wormhole guardians who basically take that message and they call the Solana contracts to let them know, like, hey, this transaction was authorized and this transfer has taken place. And now you can basically move funds from market maker to the trader on the Solana wallet. And then the Solana contract will move funds from your maker's wallet into the user wallet, right? So that's the second transfer. Yeah. So in an interchain scenario, you will just remove this wormhole messaging and both transfers will just happen on Ethereum. So the Ethereum will just move funds from user to market maker, and then it will move funds from market maker to the user on the same chain, right? So the cross-chain, you just added this extra component of message passing because it's almost like you have two different nations and you need a comms channel for them to talk to each other to facilitate, right? Yes. And what message passing does here. So it's like finding a trade route, like, you know, to go on a shipping or on a voyage to find new lands. So that's what's going on.
I love it.
That's the way to explain it.
Yeah, that's very cool. And so in my mind, this kind of opens a lot of doors to other possibilities too. Like, you know, can we trade NFTs? Can we trade, you know, other types of derivatives on using your RFQ system? Is this, you know, part of the roadmap for Hashflow? Is there any other assets?
Absolutely. So I think the way with some full-on stop at is you can trade any asset class because you're no longer limiting yourself to on-chain pricing. By moving off-chain pricing, you can pretty much offer any kind of asset and it can work pretty well, right? So I do think your derivative markets are, you know, going to be much better if you bring the order book route as opposed to strict RFQ just because of pure demand and volume that moves through it, right? But there may be some hidden alpha in what I just said around that. Order book and derivatives space, but that's all I'll leave it for this conversation. But that being said, I think the roadmap, specifically on the RFQ front, the way it's looking like, you're like, okay, we are positioning ourselves as this intent-based aggregator. But until now, we were focused on RFQ. But with the 2.0 launch, what we're trying to do is there is a world in which your market makers may not want to quote some air because it's too risky and whatnot. And yet there is a demand from a bunch of degenerates wanting to buy it, including myself. So in which case, you're almost better off tapping into liquidity that already exists on chain, like Uniswap and other venues, which you know, offer those things that no one else wants to trade. So what we want to do is, by default, we route to RFQ, but in a world where that's not available, we're like, let's just find the best optimal path for a user to trade and execute trades, right? So we are essentially beginning to position ourselves as a DEX aggregator where no matter what pair you want to trade, we'll always offer you the best rates, right? And on top of that, I think the plan here would be to expanding to different chains, including EVM and non-EVM chains. Like the chains we're looking into at the moment are on the EVM side, you're looking to Monad, Base, Say, Bearer Chain, all these. And then you're also keen on like Sui and Aptos of the movie ecosystem in general. So there's a whole bunch of things that you're looking to add in the next like 12 to 24 months. And so yeah, there's a lot to ship.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's a really good point about, you know, maybe the market maker, you know, already has a lot of inventory on their books. They're not really willing to add more in the same direction type of deal. I guess a good RFQ system has a robust network of various market makers willing to quote RFQs. How do you guys ensure to have, you know, multiple market makers onboarded? How does someone become a market maker with Hashflow? What is the sort of the behind the curtains process for that?
So anyone can become a market maker, right? So generally, I think we basically vet all the market makers that we work with. So they're all KYC'd and we put them directly to know. So we, at any given time, we know who all the liquidity providers are. That keeps us all compliant and minimizes the risk exposure at the user level. But in general, we have like 15 plus market makers at the moment who are, you know, who've been pretty active on the platform, right? And it's been a work in progress. It took like nearly a year and a half to get to that. But, and even now, like there's like still new market makers coming and entering the space. And like I said, there's many other protocols who are sort of realizing RFQ is likely superior and they're sort of adopting that model, right? So looking at Uniswap X adding like the intent-based architecture. Once again, it's sort of going towards the market maker model. And at the moment, to answer your question, how can anyone become market maker? I think they can just reach out to us directly through our website and then we'll just work with them directly to onboard them. Right? That's a simple way to do it. But if you also know anyone in your network that I should talk to you right now, I would take your money off. I would not say no.
Fantastic. I love it. And then, you know, Hashflow actually has a token out in the market right now. Maybe you could talk about sort of the token itself and the tokenomics and sort of that angle a bit as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the token is called HFT, our Hashflow token.
Good name.
Totally intended. So I think it's been live for about a year now. We launched on November 7th, right the day before FTX collapsed on November 8th. So
wow.
It was a good I think the token itself is has been trading on all the venues with Binance, Coinbase, Kraken, Bybit, you name it, right? So it's pretty much pretty liquid, available everywhere. And the core value proposition here on the token is it's primarily a governance token, but then with the new governance proposal, it also gives you access to the revenue generated by the protocol. So
nice.
The proposal went live in November and it got voted positively. So now, I think in fact, we did some free distribution last month. Last week. So anyone who's staking, not only do they get discounts on the fee, they also end up getting a portion of the network revenue, right? So one is they're getting better prices than any other DEX and they get access to all the DEX liquidity that they would otherwise don't have to put out of front ends. They can just tap into that from our platform and they can front run Uniswap fee, for example. Like you can basically get access to Uniswap ports without actually paying the 15 bips Uniswap fee on the front end. And you get access to the network revenue by staking tokens on the platform. So that's it. It's a good deal.
That's very interesting. Oh, that's cool. And then as far as like paying fees, like is there a transaction fees on both sides of every trade, or is it like a maker taker model? How does that work?
The fee is being incurred at a protocol level based on, I think what we have is what we call a dynamic fee model, where we will only charge fee, where, you know, we are already winning against all our competitors, and there's still room where we can still capture a few bips, and our quote still remains the best, right? And in a world where quotes are like not as good or at par with some other competitor, then we would not charge fees, right? So that's kind of doing it.
That's the
reason. We don't compare against Uniswap, but as an example, let's say we quoted like X and then Uniswap quoted like the same as us, right? Then we cannot really charge bot fees because that would make our quotes worse. Mm. But then on the other hand, if you quoted X and then Uniswap was quoting X minus 5, then we are at least 5 bips better than Uniswap. So if you charge 3 to 4 bips there, we'll still be superior to Uniswap, but then that can become the protocol fee, basically.
Wow, that's awesome. So as like a taker, I'm not really paying a fee. I'm just getting the best price minus a little bit shaven off if the best price is good enough to afford some fees in it. That's really fascinating. And then if anyone like wants to learn more about HFT or Hashflow, like, you know, do you guys have a blog? What's your website, Twitter, stuff like that? How can people learn more?
Our website, you know, hashflow.com is a great place to go. At Hashflow is our Twitter. For token and for trading and accessing liquidity, obviously, like, it's trading on every venue. So Binance, I think, is the most liquid place right now for trading HFTs. So you can just go and check it out there. I think.
Fantastic. And we'll have all the links in the notes below for all the listeners and YouTube viewers. And then I usually like to finish the interviews with a couple of fun questions. One of them really stands out to me. So for someone with your engineering background, your aerospace background, you know, how did you learn about the RFQ system, trading, finance in general? And is there any good books you'd recommend that you found really impactful on your journey?
I read lots of Arthur Hayes' blog.
Yeah, just so those are good.
Pretty good. But I think in terms of finance, one of the books that has had Creature from Jekyll Island.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great book. I recommend everyone to read that one. It's one of the best books I've ever read. Right. So and at least had, like, you know, I learned a lot from that.
Yeah.
It's about Edward. It's about how Federal Reserve came into being, right? So that's a really, really good book. Good read. Sovereign Individual is another one that I really like. Right. It's not to do with finance and economics, but it's, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, again, something that shaped the way I think. But then also, I would say, and then the Bitcoin Standard, that's another really, really good book that I would recommend anyone to read. And then from a startup standpoint, 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel is something, it's fabulous. So I would recommend reading that. Alternative Blake Masters, but it was Blake Masters and Peter Thiel who wrote that book together. That's really, really good. And then Paul Graham's Y Combinator essays are like really, really valuable resource. And if you really care about history in general, a story of civilization, it's like a massive book. Like, well, it's 11 volumes, right? So it's a classic, right? And by Willa Durant and Ariel Durant, it's like really, really dense. But I would recommend reading for anyone who is into history. I think you'll learn a lot.
Cool.
In your book.
That's fantastic. And then last question, what do you like to do for fun? Do you have any hobbies outside of work?
A bunch of things. So I like dancing. I've been in hip hop since high school.
Ah, nice.
Then I play the cello, and then I've been big into surfing. So I surf a lot. So
That's fantastic. I like dancing a lot too. That's one of my hobbies out here, to do a country swing dancing, which is pretty fun.
Yeah, I've been hip hop, and I'm starting Zouk and Tango. Those are like, oh, well, that's fun. And then I've been surfing. Surfing is a great sport. So
that is awesome. Well, Varun, thank you so much for coming on. It was really great to interview you and learn about your background and everything about Hashflow. Really appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. No, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.